Welcome to episode 151 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, a family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
Hi, I'm Gary Forenchik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. We're recording on the 25th of March, and I'm going to disappoint so many of you because I am not going to mention that opening day is on the 28th, but I am going to share a few other things. So John Hickner would have turned 74 2 days ago, and I want to take this as an opportunity for our listeners who knew John and would like to help to memorialize him that the four of us plus other colleagues have created a tribute fund, a scholarship, if you will, at Michigan State University. And I've posted a link in our script for those who can access that. Otherwise, you can go to the College of Human Medicine's website and go to the donor link, and they have a tribute fund. You can just type in John Hickner's name, and it will just pop up as the first item.
Thank you, Henry.
I also wanted to mention that on the 12th of April, Kate and I will be speaking at the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians Conference in Naperville, Illinois, and you can go to the Illinois Academy's website for more information.
And in the notes, it says rhymes with Paperville. I'm thinking Caperville, Vaporville, all sorts of other ones you could come up with. But it's in Naperville. So on this podcast, we highlight poems. If you want to get all of the poems, subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus, where you get one every day, plus a really great primary care reference, over 800 chapters. Check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. For a nominal fee, you can get some CME credit from the Illinois Academy. Go to their IAFP.com webpage, click on IAFP Education webpage, and find our podcast. This week, we're going to talk about risks of SSRIs and do they provoke mania in adolescents? Last thing we need. Real-world effectiveness of HPV vaccine for preventing cervical cancer. Tamiflu and the risk of hospitalization in adults with flu. And the effect of exercise on blood pressure. Kate, you're going to talk about SSRIs first.
Sure am. I have a study where the investigators analyzed data from multiple Swedish national registries between July 1st, 2006 and December 31st of 2020 to try and answer that question of whether antidepressant treatment increases the risk of manic episodes in children and adolescents who were presumed to have unipolar depression. So they identified prescriptions for any antidepressant medication from a pharmacy dispenser database. Must be nice to have those that were filled within 90 days of a diagnosis of unipolar depression in children and adolescents aged 4 to 17 years. I will note the median age was 15. The vast majority of these kids were older adolescents. So the treatment group included patients who had filled the antidepressant medication prescription within 90 days of diagnosis. There were about 24,000 of those kids. The control group included similar patients who did not fill the prescription. So they got the diagnosis, they got the prescription, but they did not fill it, according to the database. In both groups, they only included patients who had not used other psychoactive medications for at least a year prior to that index medication. About 95% of the patients started treatment with an SSRI, most commonly fluoxetine and sertraline, very similar to what I think we'd see in the U.S. After 12 weeks of follow-up, again, this was all a registry-based data study, when treatment events are most likely to happen, there were no significant differences in the recorded incidence of mania or hypomania episodes between either the treatment and the control groups. It was 0.26% and 0.20%, so the same again, and also very low. So no matter what happened to these kids, it was still a low group. Although it was, like I said, a minimal increased risk of a manic episode, including after at both 12 and 52 weeks later, they said that there any group differences that may be seen could be related to either medication use, family history, onset of psychotic symptoms were noted to increase the risk in kids where they did see it. Kids who had a history of hospitalization due to mental health also had an increased risk of manic episodes in that follow-up period. Kids who had been using anti-seizure medicines before being prescribed an antidepressant also had an increased risk, which when we talk about seizures is also an interesting thing to chase out. this study was not designed to study this specifically, but accurate diagnosis, including a thorough history and family history, and the use of validated questionnaires are also foundational prior to prescribing for children and adolescents. Henry, any thoughts on this one?
I have a couple, and it relates a little bit to the last point that you were making with regards to diagnosis and the like. You know, clinician judgment is generally pretty reasonable in terms of overall gestalt. And so a study like this can't really take into account what might be called channeling bias, where the clinician's judgment is that we're going to recommend a specific kind of therapy for patients who we perceive to be at high risk for mania. And so we may be actually seeing more an effect of the clinician's judgment and therapeutic decision-making as opposed to the drugs themselves. The second point that I want to make is that the duration of the follow-up, that one-year follow-up, I was wondering, is that long enough? And so I did a little snooping to try to see what's kind of the natural history with regards to periodicity and manic events. And I found a paper by Tondo et al. In 2017 who basically said that the rates of depression and the frequency of manic episodes were similar, a little bit more frequent for depression, but about a one per year, which seemed a little bit high to me. And so maybe 52 weeks might not be long enough to really be able to see a difference if the average is only 1 year difference. Oh, by the way, that paper also just gave a really nice historic background and pointed out that Jules Baillarger at the L'Hôpital Salpêtrière in Paris first coined that phrase, insanity of double form, and presented a paper in 1854. So I get to nerd out on history as well as methodology.
And Gary can correct your French.
Thank you.
That was pretty – I'm going to give you a solid B- on that, Henry. That guttural R sound was very well done. You know, obviously I don't take care of kids, but it doesn't matter what you do, there's downside. You know, and I tell my patients this all the time, you know, if there's a risk of mania, there's also a risk of untreated depression. Now, granted, I understand that how well was this depression established and all those kinds of things as well. And as long as they know that there's a risk there, what the, what do you want to call it, the, you know, warning signs are to look out for, I think untreated depression is also associated with downside. And I think couching it in that regard is that it doesn't matter what we do, there's going to be some downside. Which downside are we most comfortable living with? And, you know, this one seems like it's, at least if this data is true, it seems pretty minimal.
Yeah, I think the issue here was not does the SSRI cause the mania, but does it unmask it? And so, as I said, I think the biggest thing here is trying to make the most accurate diagnosis that you can and really making sure you've gone fishing for any previous episodes of mania before prescribing.
Sounds good. Always fish. Hey, Kate, tell us about the socials.
Yeah, I have the quiz this week, and I know you are all very savvy with the socials. So this week's quiz question is, how many PubMed hits does TikTok, that's a social media channel, how many TikTok PubMed hits does TikTok have? Is it A, less than 10, B, 10 to 50, C, 51 to 200, D, 201 to 500, E, 501 to 1500, or F, greater than 1500? Stay tuned for the answer. I'll be very curious to hear what you all guess.
You're going to make us guess first.
Okay, I am.
So Kate, right. Just so I understand the question, does that mean that TikTok is referenced on PubMed?
That is what the question's asking.
Okay,
how many times is the question?
I would have said
as
zero.
As opposed to TikTok users who.
So Gary's guessing A.
PubMed, yeah.
Yes, I'm guessing less than 10. We'll see.
One guess.
I'm going to say D.
Right. And I'm going to say, what's TikTok?
Yeah. Okay, Henry.
That's not an
answer. I gave you every opportunity to
say that.
Tell
us something you do know about. Yeah. We want to hear something you do know about, like HPV vaccines.
Okay. So this poem asks, how effective is the bivalent HP vaccine in preventing invasive cervical cancer? This is a paper by Palmer and colleagues in the January issue of the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. This is another database study. They went to the Scottish Cervical Cancer Recall System, Okay, so this is a really neat registry that has all of the data on cervical cancer. They use their National Health Service data to identify outcomes. They looked at the postal codes to figure out whether or not they use something called the Scottish Index of Multiple Deprivation, which takes into account employment and education levels, access to health services. It's a measure of socioeconomic status, if you will. So they looked at the frequency of HPV vaccinations, and then ultimately how many developed cervical cancer. So they got just under 500,000 women, and only 239 actually developed invasive cervical cancer. And when they looked at all of their data, it turns out that nearly all of the cancers took place in those who were unvaccinated. There's a little bit of noise, but so based on age, so if the women were vaccinated 12 to 13 years of age, whether they had only partial vaccination or complete, there were zero. Spell it out, Z-E-R, zero. Zero cases of invasive cervical cancer. For those who were vaccinated 14 and older, those who had partial vaccinations were a little bit higher risk, and those who got complete vaccination did a little bit better. So this is a really fascinating study, that sweet spot for vaccination really is in that 12 to 13-year age group. Now, keep in mind that this is the bivalent vaccine, which we are now using a nonavalent vaccine now. So my hope is that those data with the nonavalent vaccine will be even better. Mark.
Yeah, this was a good study. There was another similar study recently out of Sweden that had pretty similar results. They reported them a little bit differently, but they had for younger women, they had an incidence rate ratio of 0.12 for cervical cancer. For, I think it was 17 and older, it was 0.37. So, but still significantly reduced in both groups. And also the dose response kind of makes sense if you think about younger versus older and partial versus complete. They all fit with a pattern of effectiveness for the vaccine. So yeah, this is really good stuff, and hopefully we can improve uptake here in the States and elsewhere. Kate?
Yeah, everything that we've ever known about these HPV vaccines is that they're incredibly effective, but they are most effective if they are given before the onset of sexual activity. And that's a real difficult thing, I think, for parents of like young teenagers to sometimes wrap their heads around, that like they really have to get them into the kids before they have even thought about sexual activity, which parents like to think is around, you know, 25, 27. as the parent of teenagers, allow me to attest to that. But really, like that, you know, 11 to 13 range is really the critical age, because once they've had intercourse, even once, the vaccine efficacy falls, it plummets. And I think that's kind of borne out in this study again, as we've seen several times. And so that's the really critical thing. And that really is, especially I think in the U.S., hard for parents and public health authorities sometimes to wrap their heads around. Earlier really is better.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Henry. This is a great study. And we're never going to see randomized trial evidence for this outcome, but we, you know, do have two really well done large scale population studies that are consistent, that, you know, meet a lot of the criteria for causality, and to me anyway, are very convincing. So it's my turn to talk about Tamiflu, oseltamivir. I'll call it Tamiflu because that's what most people are used to hearing it as. This is a study from JAMA Internal Medicine by Hanula and colleagues, evaluation of oseltamivir used to prevent hospitalization in outpatients with influenza, systematic review and meta-analysis. So way back in 2012, we did the first meta-analysis that reported both published and unpublished studies of Tamiflu for the treatment of flu. Most of the studies were never published by the company. We found that overall, Tamiflu was less effective than the published trials in terms of the hours of symptom reduction. We found about 21. They've reported about 28 to 30. We also found it didn't reduce the likelihood of complications once you excluded acute bronchitis as a complication. It also didn't reduce hospitalizations, which were essentially identical in both groups. Another much larger meta-analysis got a lot more publicity. It was in BMJ a couple of years later by Jefferson and colleagues, found the same thing. Now, after that industry, you know, the Empire Strikes Back, two later industry-sponsored analyses found, surprise, surprise, a reduction in hospitalizations with Tamiflu. So the current study is an update of these meta-analyses of randomized trials that compared Tamiflu with placebo for the outcome of hospitalization. They found a total of 15 RCTs, six of which had been published since 2014. They had a total of over 6,100 participants, all confirmed to have influenza. So this is actually optimizing it for Tamiflu because everybody did actually have the flu, and they were randomized to Tamiflu or placebo. Average age was about 45, a little over 50% were female. Most of these studies, in fact, all of these studies were done in the outpatient or primary care setting. Patients who got Tamiflu were not less likely to be hospitalized. The relative risk was 0.79, non-significant. The risk difference was minus 0.17%, which is almost exactly what we found in our analysis. The range on that was minus 0.23 to plus 0.48, so not significant. And there was good homogeneity, so the results were consistent across those 15 studies. It also didn't reduce hospitalizations in older adults. Relative risk was 1.01, so right there at 1. Or high-risk patients, again, 0.65, but non-significant. The confidence interval was 0.33 to 1.28. They also looked at harms, and they did find increases in nausea with a number needed to harm of 9, and vomiting, number needed to harm of 6. So not serious harms, but annoying, certainly. There was no increase in cardiovascular, neurologic, or psychiatric events, though, which had been reported by some Japanese studies back in the early 2000s. So the song remains the same. There is no evidence that Tamiflu reduces the likelihood of hospitalization, even in high-risk or older patients, and it has pretty common, although non-serious, harms. The only real benefit is a reduction in symptom duration of less than a day, which is, I think at a public health level, certainly not a reason we should be stockpiling these drugs or getting too terrifically excited about them. Gary.
I think the answer is Led Zeppelin, right? Isn't it?
Isn't it? Yes, that's right. So I thought of an extra credit quiz. We got to ask the question, which 1970s band had the song Remain the Same on their fifth album? People can't read this, Gary, that are listening. But thank you for providing the answer of Led Zeppelin.
It's my era. It's my era.
Yeah, mine too.
I got two or three comments on this. Number one, I don't think they looked at the ultimate transmission to other people. It would be really interesting to find out from a public health standpoint whether or not this decreased transmission. And granted, I understand that wasn't the point of this. I think number two is, I don't remember the last time I actually had clinical flu, but man, it was bad. It was really bad. It was like, taking a shower, I had to take a nap for 3 hours type of a thing. And that 10-hour difference in terms of symptoms, quality of life matters, right? So I wouldn't necessarily minimize that as an outcome. And I think number three is, it would be really interesting to find out, and maybe this was embedded in here, Mark, and maybe it wasn't, but, were these people who were ultimately vaccinated and were likely to get, quite frankly, a minimal, a symptom complex from the flu anyways, were they able to tease that out, vaccinated versus non-vaccinated?
I wrote this one up. I don't remember that they talked about that at all. I mean, a lot of the data for these studies came from the late 1990s and early around 2000. That's when the original industry trials were done. And then a bunch of the data came from several more recent trials in Europe, where actually flu vaccine uptake in the countries they studied was not very good. So I suspect probably, and I don't remember. The right answer is I don't remember, but it's a great point. 20 hours, I think if you catch it early, certainly if you catch it within the first 24 hours, you can get even more benefit, about 30 hours benefit. And that's probably, clinically meaningful. My point was that a lot of countries had decided to stockpile this drug, spend billions of dollars on it, because it was thought to prevent hospitalizations, and it really doesn't appear to. So not saying don't prescribe it. Know the limitations. Certainly in somebody who's admitted to the hospital very sick, I would probably still prescribe it regardless of the timing, because the harms are low and the potential benefit is there based on some observational studies. But for the routine person, I think it's a conversation. Do you want to take this? Oh yeah, I took it before and it made me puke. I'd rather not. I think it's not something we should automatically be doing, I guess. All right, Gary, your turn. You're going to close us out here.
Yeah, so this is from a reader. Actually, I'm sitting in his office as we speak, one of my colleagues, Anthony. who said, "Hey, why don't you guys talk about this article?" And you know, we both have the same mindset toward, you know, we want to call it lifestyle modifications and its effect on health. So he sent me this article published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine last year. And the article is entitled "Exercise Training and Resting Blood Pressure, a Large-Scale, Pairwise, and Network Meta-Analysis of RCTs." Research question. To assess the effects of various modes of exercise on resting blood pressure and an attempt to establish an optimal antihypertensive exercise prescription practice. It was a systematic review, network meta-analysis of 270 randomized trials, but only 15,000 participants. I say only, that's a small number, but you know, each trial appeared to have a smaller number of patients in it. The articles were published between 1990 and 2023, and they had to report on reductions of both systolic and diastolic blood pressure that followed at least a two-week exercise intervention. And it had to compare it to a non-exercise intervention. So they had a nice control and comparison group. So what did they find? They looked at four elements of exercise. I'll define these in a minute. One was isometric. The other one was combined. The third one is dynamic resistance. And the fourth one was aerobic training. So what does all this mean? I actually thought isometric exercises were no longer a thing, but apparently they are. So this is where you contract a muscle against some object, but the muscle doesn't actually move. It doesn't shorten, basically. So you're actually going against something you can't possibly move. So that's isometric. And it turns out, surprising to me, that that was the most effective intervention for lowering blood pressure. About 8/4 in terms of the systolic-diastolic differential between them and the control group. When you looked at combined training, it was a combination of aerobic, the usual, you know, get your heart rate up and sweat a little bit, and resistance training within the same exercise, you know, regimen. That was 6/3, basically. So again, you know, not insubstantial. Dynamic resistance, which is like when you're actually lifting weights and moving or shortening your muscles, that was 4/3, basically, or 5/3 in terms of reduction. And then finally, one that I would have guessed a priori would have been the most effective, it was actually the least effective. It wasn't mean it wasn't effective. So aerobic training, basically cardio, lowered the blood pressure by about 4.5 over about 2.5. Interestingly, then they did a secondary analysis and they said, okay, if this isometric exercise is the most effective, which type of isometric exercise was most effective? And I actually tried this before we came on air here. It's an isometric wall squat. So if you get up and put your back against a wall and squat down like you're sitting and just, you know, do that for as long as you can, that was the isometric exercise that seemed to have the greatest benefit in terms of lowering blood pressure. And then when for systolic blood pressure, excuse me, when they looked specifically at diastolic blood pressure, the one that I a priori thought was most effective was diastolic blood pressure. Was lowered to a greater effect with running, basically. So I like this study. It's simple. I mean, I think this, what do they call it? The isometric wall squat seems relatively easy to do. It's just one thing to add to the many things we might consider when it comes to this concept of lifestyle modification and its effect on blood pressure. Obviously, short term, 2 weeks was a minimal. I don't know how long the longest went, and they didn't measure real clinical outcomes like stroke rates, heart attacks, you know, kidney failure, and the like. But you know, it seems like it's harmless.
Kate, what do you think? And I forgot to let you comment on the flu poem, if you want to throw anything in about that.
No, I feel like we covered everything there was to say about flu, but I have lots of thoughts about this one. So it feels underwhelming. You know, for as much time as we spend telling people to, like, you know, exercise, you'd expect more than like a 4-point reduction in blood pressure. And I don't know, that 8-point seems like there were only 2 studies or something. I don't know if you know how many isometric exercise studies were included in the 270. But it's so much different than like the cardio ones. And I agree with you. I feel like usually there's, you know, we're all about like walk for 150 minutes, you know, moderate intensity cardiovascular. But if there were far fewer in the isometric category. A couple of years ago, we were doing I don't remember, something for the residency. And we actually looked up I think the American Heart Association says, you know, exercise can lead to a 10-point reduction in blood pressure. And we pulled their references, and none of they only had 2 to begin with, and neither of them supported that. They found exactly what you're saying, which was like a 4-6 point at best. And I felt, you know, just absolutely betrayed by the American Heart Association, not for the first time, I'll add. But yeah, you know, you just, because that wouldn't necessarily, in almost every case, that wouldn't be the difference between starting medication and not starting medication. So it's a good idea and everybody should do it. And I also feel like, you know, patients can do everything right and it still won't, you know, it won't give them the outcomes that they want.
So, Kate, are you saying that the American Heart Association is in the pockets of big exercise?
I don't doubt it, quite honestly. I mean, again, it's the problem that I have. It's good advice, and everyone should do it. The problem that I have is when we keep saying to patients, like, hey, if you eat right and exercise, if you do, what do they call it? It used to be Life Simple 7. They call it, there's eight of them now. I can't remember what it's like Easy 8 or something. But it's like, if you do all these things, it should be so easy to keep yourself healthy. But it's really, like, not necessarily. Like, some people, like, have high blood pressure because it runs in their family or whatever. And, you know, like, if you exercise, it does not necessarily mean that your blood pressure will be normal. But we're like, yeah, just like 4 points. Are you kidding me?
Well, that's where you need those healthy heartbeat shoes or whatever they call them. They advertise.
They really don't advertise that.
They support healthy heart energy. They support healthy heart energy. I just saw.
They only advertise that on the Golf Channel in the middle of the day.
It's true.
You're watching the Golf Channel in the middle of the day. Who knew? Okay.
I'm not. That's what I'm saying.
So Kate, when I was a medical student, they would describe these patients who, in spite of all of their best efforts, would have bad outcomes as having poor protoplasm. So I think your concern is really, you know, healthy people will stay healthy no matter what they do. And, you know, these are all kind of confirming that that to be the case. I would love to see a similar study in patients who actually have hypertension and what happens then with regards to medication use and their outcomes. You know, this is purely a dose study and really lacks really the important outcomes. And Gary, you touched on that, but I think it's worth reinforcing. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily harmless, since especially if you strain your back while doing those exercises.
And all the grunting.
Ugh. Oh my God. Yeah.
All right. I'm challenging every single one of you. As soon as we're done with this podcast, go to the wall and do a wall squat and see how easy it is.
See how my blood pressure. They actually did a network meta-analysis of this. This is an interesting study. I still can't find the number of trials, but
the number is the 3-4 millimeters reduction. That's what in the task force reviews for healthy lifestyle recommendations. That's what we found too. And that was my point. It was like, it's not terribly exciting. Well, the arguments were on a population level, it'll make a difference and blah, blah, blah. But
if you add that to, you know, salt restriction, if you add that to, you know, weight modification, if you add that to, you know, moderation in alcohol use, you know, 4+4+4+4, you're starting to get into real numbers. So I think, you know, I don't think anybody would look at this to say this is the be all and end all. It's just part of the puzzle.
I'm trying to remember the last of my patients that came in with mild hypertension that we started on lifestyle changes and that ended up not starting a medication eventually. I think I'd have to, I don't know if that's ever happened, but maybe that's just me. Okay. All right. I'm enough being a cynic. I'll be less cynical next time, I promise. Hey, tell us about TikTok.
Sorry, I'm still reading that article. Yeah. Let me find my, I got distracted there. Right. The question again is, how many PubMed hits does TikTok, the social media channel, have? Henry, I'll explain it later. So TikTok has been in the news as the U.S. Congress tries to decide whether to ban Chinese ownership of it. This is a policy decision I don't know enough about to have an opinion about, but that drove me to think more about the platform itself, which I also don't really know enough about to have an opinion on. I do, as I said, keep multiple teenagers in my house, and my patients use it all the time, so I really should know more about it than I do. So I went to PubMed, where I get most of my knowledge from, to look it up. TikTok, all one word, no letter C in either half, was released in the U.S. in April 2020 when the country had a huge amount of spare time on its hands. The Google trend for it is a straight upward surge with a solid plateau at the top since. It's very popular. If you have a chance to look at our script, I put the Google trend results for TikTok, all one word, TikTok, two words, which is a surge and then a fall, as we all learned how to spell it. TikTok, like a clock, it's a flat line. No one searches that. And then tick, which has a really neat seasonal variation to it. People search for ticks during tick season. Anyways, medicine is behind. 1.8 billion people use TikTok worldwide. We have managed to write about it just 575 times in PubMed. Baikal, you all remember Baikal, had approximately the same lifespan, about 4 years, and it achieved more than 800 citations, although to be fair, we have continued to write about it since its demise. So even if you aren't on the TikTok, probably best to be aware of what is going on there and see what your patients and colleagues, a lot of doctors and other medical clinicians, are hearing and learning on the TikTok. That is my
Dr. Glaucoma-Flecken. Dr. Glaucoma-Flecken is my favorite.
Among others, people are actually sharing medical information on there for better or for worse.
Mostly for worse.
Well, you need to do the same thing for X. So next time, let's do an X one also and see how often that shows up.
Yeah.
Lots and lots. Yeah. Well, no, Twitter was used for, you know, identifying surges in influenza, and it's actually better than the CDC. A while ago.
Yeah, you can do the same kind of Google Trends things for like cough and fever and look at how people search seasonally for those things.
Okay, well, thanks, guys. That was fun. Thanks for listening, everybody. Again, ifp.com if you want to get CME credit. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends about our podcast, Primary Care Update. We'll talk to you soon with more Primary Care Updates.